If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, our weekly opportunity to take a look at the world of theater and the arts. Today, we're going to do something related, a little bit to the side of theater and the arts, but if you think about it, theater, the arts are all based on language and words and how words get written. Think of the playwright. Think of the screenwriter. And so I read this book, the author of whom appeared on our morning show, which also brought it to my attention. But the book is called Says Who? A Kinder, Funner, is that a word? We'll find out. Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. Its author, Anne Curzan, joins me today. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Paul. Great to be here.
Well, and so good to see you. And it's you are a professor of this language stuff at University of Michigan. I know you do a lot of radio and media. And are you still the dean of the College of LAS?
I am not. I finished in June of 2024.
And that's why I asked, because those are, as a former academic, I know we live those titles for a while and then we move on.
That's right.
But anyway, what a great book. What a fun book. Is it fair enough to say you're a grammar nerd and that's what got you into all this? I do appreciate grammar. It drives me crazy when people misuse it.
I am a total nerd. I love that I have spent my entire career studying language and figuring out why English is the way it is. And as you know, in the book, I introduced the term wordy, which is a relatively new word for someone who loves words. And I would say that I am a committed wordy. It sounds like you are as well. And then in the book, I also introduced the term grammando, which is was introduced by Lizzie Skernick in the New York Times Sunday Magazine over 10 years ago. And it's someone who constantly corrects other people's grammar. And in writing the book, I realized that actually, I think each one of us has a wordy, a little inner wordy and a little inner grammando in our head. And I'm trying to help the inner wordy get a really big microphone so that we can be curious and enjoy language.
And it makes sense. By the way, let me just kick this off with the title, A Kinder, Funner. So a lot of people would say funner is not a word. There's a lot of stuff in this book where you go, people don't think that's real, whatever. And then you often tell us it is and why. But funner, is it about funner or should this say a kinder, more fun?
Yes. Well, I knew that title would be provocative and hoped it would mean that people would pick up the book because they would think I'm going to disagree with her. And there's a chapter called The Funnest Chapter. And what I think funner really nicely highlights is the role that kids, little kids play in language change, as well as the systematicity of language. So in this case, what's going on is that fun for most of its history was a noun. And it was only a noun. And of course, it's still a noun. And we can say, I had fun. And there, fun is a noun. But in the early 20th century, fun got reinterpreted to also be an adjective, because if an adult said the party was fun and the adult meant it as a noun, like the party was chaos, a little kid hears it and fun sure sounds like an adjective there. The party was boring. The party was interesting. The party was fun. So the little kid decides that fun is an adjective as they learn the language. And if you think about one-syllable adjectives, if you make a comparative, they tend to take ER, tall, taller, and then the superlative tallest, wide, wider, widest, fun, funner, funnest. And so little kids do that until they get corrected by some adult who says, "Ugh, funner is a terrible word." And then the kid files that away. Like, I don't know, guess there's something wrong with that one. And Paul, what I think is happening here, and I do surveys with undergraduates, people have a very strong reaction to funner still, but funnest elicits a less strong reaction. And so I think that funnest will come in first into more standard usage, and you see it in advertising already, and then funner will scoot in behind it.
eventually. We're a little behind. Well, this is a theater show, so let me take you into the world of theater as we talk about language, and we'll learn some things and rules as we go. But I want to start. I'm going to just go to Shakespeare. Because, you know, I mean, that's kind of like it goes back centuries and whatever. Why is it that, and today, for example, the Goodman Theater will often do Shakespeare, but they will play with it. They will modernize the language sometimes, or they'll modernize the dress and the setting. And even if they use the traditional Shakespeare language, we follow it better because we can watch this visual that helps us understand what's going on. When is it that we went from understanding back in Shakespeare's day what he was saying, because I imagine everybody went to see those shows and talked like he did. And then today, if we talk that way, why thou art, we're like, what are you doing? When did it happen that all that thing fell out of favor? Is it about the years and the centuries? Is it about the culture, the British versus, when did that happen?
Well, the wonderful thing about being a historian of the English language, which is how I describe myself, is that I will never go out of business. Because the language is always changing. And so Shakespeare, we can understand much better than, say, Chaucer, which is harder. You go back a couple hundred more years. And then if you go all the way back to Beowulf around the year 1000, we can't understand it at all. So I had to take courses in Old English to be able to understand it. But the language is constantly changing. The grammar is changing. The vocabulary is changing. So there's never sort of one moment where things change. They're changing all the time. They're changing all around us right now. And so we could take the example, Paul, that you used of there are all these thous in there, like thou and thee. Right. Well, Shakespeare was living through a very interesting shift in the pronouns that we're still living through. One was that thou and thee were slowly dropping out of the language, except for a couple of varieties that still use it. Historically, thou and thee were the singular, and ye and you were the plural. And by Shakespeare's time, that distinction wasn't really working anymore. You were getting a formal, informal distinction. So that you was the more formal and thou was the more informal. And Shakespeare actually has a line where he says, you know, don't thou me, right? Don't be too informal with me. And then eventually thee and thou fall out of the language. You and ye are both singular and plural in standard varieties of English. But another interesting thing going on in Shakespeare, which will give everyone something to listen to, is that ye was also falling out of the language. So in Old English and Middle English and Early Modern English, Shakespeare's time, ye was the subject and you was the object. In the same way that I is the subject and me is the object, he, him, she, her. So you had ye as the subject, you as the object, but that was collapsing. And if you look at Shakespeare's plays, he struggles to keep his yees and yous straight. So he uses ye as a subject and an object and you as a subject and an object. And when I read Shakespeare, nobody ever told me that.
Yeah, I kind of skipped it. Well, that leads to a couple of follow-ups, not on my list of things to ask you, but, you know, in other languages like French, there would be the informal version of you, tu, and then the more formal version of singular you, vous. Did English have that at one point? Was there a more formal and informal way of just saying you and he and she and all that?
Yeah, well, so in the Renaissance, Shakespeare could play with that, that during that period, you had you as the more formal, thou and thee as the less formal. And both of them could function as a singular, formal, and informal. But clearly that was a distinction that just didn't make it in the long term in English. And now we have you, formal, informal, singular, and plural. Although, of course, what you and I know is that in subsequent centuries, we have created new plural forms of you. Mm-hmm. So in the south of the United States, you get y'all, or all y'all. Right. Or you get yous, or yins, or you guys, or yous guys, all these plural forms to distinguish between singular you and plural you.
And what about, you know, somebody might hear what we're saying as you're saying Shakespeare and before Shakespeare. Well, let's go to the Bible just for a moment, which is to say, I'm guessing that the Bible people read today, even though it has references to, like, you know, get to know her, you know, the phrases that we have to know what it was referencing. But if we were to pick up kind of an original version of that Bible, would we really not understand it at all? Are we reading modern translation. I know we are reading modern translations, but my point is if there was an original version, which we'd go, I don't understand any of this.
So the Bible was translated in different periods and, of course, would use the language of that period. So those early translations of the Bible would not be something that people could understand without a course and a dictionary. So certainly that is true. And then the King James Bible, published in 1611, in some cases was from what we can tell, intentionally archaic. So it uses a lot of hath and doth, which probably even then was a little bit archaic, but I think it sounded more formal and appropriate for a Bible translation at the time.
Let me return to the arts now. And the other thing that triggers in my head is like Mark Twain. Because obviously when in Huckleberry Finn, for example, which became a musical it's often put on shows, but there is this struggle that theaters and directors ultimately have, which is to say the language that Twain used, we can't use today, in insulting words, about African Americans or whatever. And so in his day, when he was writing it, people use those words, maybe sometimes insultingly, but sometimes it was just a reference one could use at that time. Today we're going, we can't do that. Do you have a view about, well, A, why that changed? I mean, why it is that a word was okay and now it's not? By the way, I don't have to, even go sort of racial with it. I mean, you even write in the book about woman versus lady. I mean, terms change over time. What is it that triggers something to become insulting and negative? And then I guess I'm going to ask you for maybe your academic opinion, which is if you were putting on a presentation or production of Huck Finn, would you say we must be true to Twain, or would you say no, we have to be sensitive to today's morals?
It's such an important question, Paul, and a really complicated one, as you recognize in the question itself. So we can start with the first part, which is this question about what linguists would call taboo language. So language that is so powerful that we don't want to say it. And just that in and of itself is fascinating to think about this set of syllables, sounds and syllables, and we think that carries so much power that it is harmful in some way to say it. And taboo, from what we can tell, all languages have taboo words. They often center around things like religion, death, sex, particular body parts. And then the one, some of the words you're talking about, epithets for people. And right now, some of the most explosive words in contemporary English are epithets for people that we just say, I'm not, I will not say that. It can do so much harm. And some people would say it's really kind of interesting that some of the swear words that would have been very taboo 50 or 100 years ago seem to feel a little bit less taboo. And there are words that you now see on television that you would not have seen on television.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, even when I was a kid, that you would not have seen those words
Or go
on.
to cable and hear them all.
That's exactly right. So those change over time. A big part of that is social traditions and beliefs and attitudes. It's always interesting when people learn that in the 19th century, the word leg was considered to be pretty taboo as a body part because women's legs were seen as sexual. And you think about sort of long dresses and that would cover the legs. And so, you know, now leg seems like a completely neutral word, would not have been at that time. So it's unsurprising that you have words that are taboo. And I think it's part of respecting cultural norms to be highly aware of those words. And certainly it's something that dictionary editors are thinking about all the time in terms of how do you capture in a dictionary entry how taboo a word is.
Powerful stuff. But irregardless of this conversation, we need to take a break. I know viewers are now going, irregardless?
Irregardless.
I'm going to ask you about that one. But we're going to take a quick break and then come back to talk about that and just lots of other really fun things. Is it well? Is it good? It's going to be funner than it was this time. And we're going to come back and do that with Ann Curzon right after these words. Stay with us. And we are back behind the curtain with Ann Curzan, who has written the book Says Who. It's just a really great look at language. We talked about how it's used in theater and Shakespeare and all of that. But going into the break, and I, of course, in a fun way, sort of said, irregardless, we have to go to a break. And you know what I'm talking about. There are people who use words that are so commonly used that you think they're right. And of course, the point is, should it be regardless of that or irregardless of that? People will argue both ways. I will forever say irregardless is wrong.
Yes. Well, and I tell the story in the book about a friend of mine who has become a dear friend. But when I met him early on, he found out what I do, that I study language change. And he said, the next thing I know, you're going to tell me irregardless is a word. And I don't know exactly what my face did, but clearly it indicated that that was what I was going to tell him. And he said, my respect for you just went down three notches. So this is an important thing to know about dictionaries and dictionary editors, which is that they would say they are just trying to keep up with all of us. That as we use the language and we change the language and we have variation across varieties of the language, dictionary editors see themselves as trying to record all that variation and change. And so when I hear people say, well, is irregardless a word? I'm like, well, yes, because people use it and other people know what they mean when they use it. They mean regardless. And it's in most dictionaries because the word is out there and dictionary editors are just trying to record what's going on in the language. I totally get the argument that irregardless is redundant because you have the negative IR at the beginning and the less at the end. And it's this blend of regardless and irrespective. There are, it looks like, varieties in which irregardless is actually the emphatic form of regardless. So when you're really drawing the line, you say, irregardless, I'm not going. That is the end of this argument. But it's also not the only word in English that has a redundancy in it. And I know this is a slightly odd example, but the verb to bone, as in to take the bones out of a chicken, mm-hmm. for example. So you can bone a chicken and take the bones out.
Debone, right?
Well, or you can debone a chicken and they mean the same thing. And so actually debone is redundant.
Now, I don't think that one was in the book. If it is, I missed that. But I agree with that. I do have to say, though, I couldn't care less. Or or could I care less?
Yes.
Could I or couldn't I? I those are different, Anne. If I could care less, then there is more caring I could give up.
It is absolutely true that there is technically, if you said I could care less, that you are saying that there is more caring.
But that's not the way people mean it.
Yeah, and this is just a fact about idioms. So idioms, these phrases that come to mean what they mean. And so at this point, particularly depending on the intonation, but if you say, ugh, I could care less, it means I don't care. And your listeners know that. So idioms, you're largely not parsing for the meaning of each word and the grammar. The idiom means what it means. And here's a great example that is not in the book, which is the phrase to pull oneself up by one's bootstraps.
Yeah.
So, Paul, what does that mean for you?
By the way, that sounds like an old person's term now. I can't see my kids saying that. But yeah, it's sort of like deal with whatever life has given you and get it together and move on.
Yeah. And for some people, sort of live the American dream, right? Like you can do it yourself. You pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You make your own money. Well, when that phrase came into English in the middle of the 19th century, it meant to try to do the impossible. Because actually, it is impossible if you have those little straps in the back of your boot to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. That is impossible. And there are these
What's a bootstrap?
They still have them. If you have like a low boot, it's that little loop.
No, I know. It's that little, right.
It's the little
loop. Just for the young people listening to us who don't know what it is.
Exactly. But there are these great, in the middle of the 19th century, people are like, pulling oneself up by one's own bootstraps is like trying to put yourself in a wheelbarrow and wheel yourself around.
By the way, back to the arts for a little bit. Did Hemingway get it wrong? Should it be for who the bell tolls? Did Dr. Seuss get it wrong? Should it be Horton? Here's a whom? A whom?
Well, as you know from the book, I'm really careful about how I talk about right and wrong. There is the standardized variety of the language, the formal variety, and still to this day, technically, you would say for whom the bell tolls, because it's the object of the preposition. But whom has been trying to die for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think many of us experience that if we say something like, to whom should I send this letter? It sounds very formal and probably too formal for most situations. And so I would tend to say, who should I send this to? Where I have who instead of whom, and I've moved the to the end of the question so that I don't have the to whom at the beginning. Because all of that can sound, to me, very English professory, and I don't always want to sound like an English professor.
And that's all well and good. Or is it well or good? Is it good? Well, does it matter?
Did you grow up with prescriptions about this in terms of if someone said, how are you, Paul, what you were supposed to say?
I don't remember growing up with that. I mean, but if somebody said, how I am, I know I'm colloquially going to, but just sort of say, I'm good, even though I think well is appropriate.
And they're both fine.
Well, you give
I
us
have
something. We
friends.
can say what we want.
On this one, you can say, I'm well, I'm good. And I think, at least for me, to say I'm well is largely about health. Like, I'm healthy, I'm well, and I'm good is I'm in a good place. And I know people who say, you aren't talking about your moral goodness, so you should say I'm well and not I'm good. But you can say I'm good and not be talking about your moral goodness. It can just be I'm in a good place.
If we were writing a play or a script or something, ending in a preposition is something that I think often happens. That is one thing. As somebody, I've written 15 books, whatever. It drives me nuts. And when I'm correcting student papers in the past, or people ask me to read something, that drives me crazy. You have a Winston Churchill quote in the book, which I hadn't heard before, and I just love it, where he says, "That's a silly rule. Up with which up with I will not put." I mean, just Churchill. If he actually said all these things that are claimed that he said, I
Right.
mean, what an amazing guy. But that being said, what about ending sentences with prepositions? Can we talk differently than we write? Is that acceptable?
So let me start with that question. Of course. And we do speak differently from the way that we write. And one of the things that I think it's important to realize is that we can be much more ambiguous when we speak because we have a lot more context. We can use shorthands. And if somebody's confused, they can ask. And one of the really challenging things about writing is that it cannot tolerate the same level of ambiguity because if I'm writing something, I'm not going to be there likely when someone reads it. And so it needs to be crystal clear what I mean. And I really wish someone had said that to me when I was an emerging writer of this is part of what's so hard is you're trying to minimize ambiguity in writing. And then, of course, there's more formal writing, which will follow different kinds of rules.
Yeah.
But it's also important to realize that some of those rules we've created are artificial. We can change them over time. And this gets us to the rule of you can't end a sentence with a preposition. And that rule started out as a preference. John Dryden and others who said, I think it is more elegant if you don't end a sentence with a preposition. But English has long been able to end sentences with preposition. Dryden was just saying, I think it's more elegant. And over time, it stopped being about elegance and started being about correctness, as if there was something wrong with ending a sentence with a preposition. But now I think it can sound really formal to bump the preposition forward, less formal to have it at the end. And that's the way, Paul, that I wish we were having these conversations about language, that we could move away from this is categorically right and this is categorically wrong to saying, you know, the best playwrights and poets and authors have really big toolboxes of language. They have formal and informal, and they know when to use what.
We're going to have to wrap up in just about a minute, but quickly, I'm on the flip side to that. You tell us it's okay to begin a preposition, to begin a sentence with a preposition like and or but. I'm like, wait a minute. And something has to come before it, but something has to be before it. And you say, ah, don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, that one, from what we can tell, is a superstition created by English teachers that you cannot start a sentence with the conjunctions and or but. You look at great authors, they have been doing that for centuries, and it often can work really well to start a sentence with and but.
Then, as final words, what do you say to our viewers, our listeners who, try to get it right, but they say things that maybe some people, what is your message to them? Be yourself or read the book.
My message is, I hope you can be curious about language and enjoy language. And let's think about it as using language that is effective depending on who your audience is, what the context is, and what you're trying to get done.
That makes sense. It's a very forgiving book, and it's one I think that gives people hope because essentially you acknowledge it many times. Look, people say something a certain way, and it's okay. I guess the main thing is as long as we understand what you're trying to say, maybe that's the main thing. Maybe I didn't word it in the best of grammar, the best of language, but if you get my message, we're good.
And that we speak and write across many, many contexts, and what works in one context may not work in another. So again, the biggest toolbox with knowledge about how to use the tools, that makes for savvy writers and speakers.
Anne Curzan, the book is Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. And I care about words, and our morning show folks cared about words, and I think our viewers and listeners care about them as well. This is very fun. And the book is an easy read. There's so many stories. You meet somebody at a wedding, you just all these places, and when people find out what you do, I get it. I talk politics on TV, and people find out I do that. We got to have that conversation. And of course, you and I would both say, "Can I not do that?" Although I think you're nicer about it. But anyway, congratulations on a great book. I appreciate your spending time with me behind the curtain, and I hope to talk to you again soon, whether or not. Whether or not. Thanks, Anne. Thanks for being with me.
Oh, thanks for your delight in language.
And thanks for joining us here behind the curtain. We'll see you next time, everybody.